Well, coming off a song like that, I feel like it's appropriate to talk about horror movies for a moment. The thing is, you and I are going to have a different definition of what constitutes a horror movie. You're probably thinking of something like Exorcist. I'm thinking of something like Meet the Parents, okay? Now, see, for me, the genre that's considered comedy is essentially horror. Here's why, okay? These comedies are really good at creating situations where something looks one way, but it's really another, and it's really uncomfortable. So a classic example for commercial, this commercial was floating around for a while, where person A is eating a brownie at a park, and they drop the brownie on the ground, so they go to pick it up, while person B is walking by with their dog, and person C simply sees this person picking up a brown object behind the dog, right? And as he's eating it, person C has this look of horror on her face. That's what these movies do. And so what we have to know about me is I'm what's called an Enneagram 9. So if you don't know anything about Enneagrams, that's okay. It's another personality thing, kind of like Myers-Briggs, except those people would kind of get annoyed if you call it personality. It really has to do with like your core motivations and fears in life. And so as an Enneagram 9, my core motivation in life is to keep things at peace. And my number one fear is that peace is disrupted. So when it comes to a movie like Meet the Parents, I am on edge the entire time. I don't know if you saw that one, but Ben Stiller, right, he's this prospective groom for this girl, and he goes to meet her parents, and he meets Robert De Niro's character. And so throughout the entire movie, what's happening is things like that commercial, where something's happening, and it looks like Ben Stiller is this really horrible guy, but it's just because of the context. But Robert De Niro walks in, sees him picking up a brown thing behind a dog, and assumes this guy's like the worst thing in the world for my daughter. For me, this is the equivalent of like The Exorcist, right? This really happens in my house. I take a blanket during these scenes, throw it over my head and ask my wife to tell me when the scene's over. It is horrifying. It ruins my inner peace. And Enneagram 9s can tell you that we spend a lot of energy trying to keep that peace. Now you might look at me or interact with me and decide that I'm generally a peaceful person. I try really hard at that. But it's exhausting sometimes. It really is. And that's because no matter what Enneagram type you are, right, peace can be difficult to come by. A deep-seated peace where we can say, it is well with my soul and mean it, is difficult. Because in this world, there are so many things happening around us that it can be a challenge to keep this sense that God really is at work and has the world in his hands. Because sometimes it feels like things are spiraling out of control. And yet today, we're going to continue in our series where we've been talking about the names of God, names that show up throughout the Bible to describe a little bit about who God is. And this is another one of those Hebrew names, which means that we're going to start with the name Jehovah, or you can say Yahweh, whichever you prefer, and then you're going to add another word onto it. And somewhere in the Old Testament, someone identified that the second word is so crucial to the characteristics of God that these words needed to be combined into one idea. And so today we're going to talk about Jehovah Shalom. The Lord is peace. Now, if you've ever done a word study on the word shalom, you'll know this. It's bigger than our sense of peace. A lot of times we talk about peace as being an absence of conflict. And we're not going to be able to get into it all today, but shalom is much more encompassing than that. In some ways, you can think of it as wholeness. That everything is sort of right. Everything is whole. And yet for Israel, throughout their history, they had problems with peace. They had problems with wholeness for sure, but they had problems just with conflict. And when you read the stories in the Old Testament, you see this pattern happens over and over again. God does something really great for Israel. They praise God for it. Some time passes. They kind of forget about it. And they do something else. And then bad things happen. And God gets them out of that situation. And then they kind of forget about God. And bad things happen. And God gets them out of that situation. And on it seems to go over and over again. In our story today, we're going to be in Judges chapter 6, by the way, if you want to turn there. In Judges chapter 6, we're right in the middle of this sort of oscillating reality with Israel. Sometimes they're faithful. In fact, if you go back to the end of chapter 5, they were faithful. And now they're at this point again where they're forgetting God. And things aren't going nearly as well. Now, one of the things that's important to realize is this. A lot of times in the Old Testament, we talk about Israel forgetting God. Their version of forgetting God isn't like me at the grocery store where inevitably I fail to get something by the time I get home, right? Isn't forgetting an answer for a test. They remember that Yahweh exists. In fact, they look back in their history, they even know that this is the God that got them out of Egypt, and yada, yada, yada. This God had been faithful in the past. What they were forgetting was functional. They weren't trusting in this God anymore. Something else had stepped in to that place. I want you to read this. This is what it says in Judges chapter 6, verse 10. This is God speaking to Israel, who's now crying out to God because there's so many bad things happening. "I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you have not listened to me." So Israel, they inhabited this promised land. They had ousted these other people. And when they showed up, there were these gods that were theoretically tied to the land. That was something that they kind of believed. There were these local gods. And they were tied to the actual ground on which you stood. So if you stepped into a particular land, there was a particular god that, of course, the locals worshipped. And so when they conquered these people, they had learned about the gods that they worshipped. Now, Israel wasn't supposed to worship anybody but Yahweh. And yet, over time, as their faithfulness went up and down, at their down moments, they would begin to actually worship these theoretical local gods. They would build idols. They'd build statues. And you say, yes, we know that Yahweh got us out of Egypt, but also, you know, there's this local God and we may as well worship him too. And that was their pattern. It's not that they forgot God. It's just they forgot that God was everything. That there was nothing else that they were supposed to follow. They had gotten into this trap of trusting in God and something. For them, in this story, it was Baal. He happened to be the local deity. And so they had statues of Baal. Now, we're not used to going into a city if we have to move, say, for a job change or something like that, and asking around the locals, hey, what's the local god around here, right? If we did that, people might, well, let's not do that. Okay, don't do that. But for us, that's not the issue. The issue is the thing that we trust besides God. And for Christians, this is the biggest trap, because generally speaking, we do trust God, and it's not too often in our life that we completely abandon trust in God. What usually happens is our trust begins to shift, and we trust in God and something. And it's that something that messes the whole thing up. It might not be Baal, but it might be God and general sense of peace in my life. Nothing's going wrong here. That absence of conflict that we talked about. God and I have pretty good control over my life. God and I have a bank account that I can fall back on. God and my family. God and myself. And whatever you fill in that blank with, that's the thing that's competing now with Yahweh, the God of the universe. And while we never meant to disenfranchise God from our lives, there's something else that's taking that place of our trust, and that's what we call idolatry. It doesn't have to carry the name Baal. It just has to be something that functionally we're putting our trust in. Now, in this story, there is this local God, and you can understand how they got there. Things were going pretty bad. The Midianites in the story, as you'll learn, they were the ones who were basically taking over everything. The enemy was constantly at Israel's door, and it didn't seem like Yahweh was delivering them, and so, of course, they're going to start to look for other things. Maybe this local God, if we appease this local God, he'll do something. This is the context of Gideon's story, and this is the lesson that Gideon is going to have to learn. There is no God and, there is only God. Judges chapter 6, verse 11, we're introduced to Gideon. "The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak at Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a winepress to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, 'The Lord is with you, mighty warrior.'" Here is Yahweh coming back to a people who wanted his presence, who had been crying out to his presence, but had been doing evil by worshiping these other gods. It's now Gideon, here at this wine press, trying to protect his food stores from the Midianites, is encountered by this angel of the Lord, which we'll just say is sort of a manifestation of God for simplicity. God's showing up in front of Gideon, saying, "Here I am. The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." But Gideon doesn't know what to do with this. Because despite this pretty incredible message, there's a lot of hurdles in his mind about what's going on here. I told you, Gideon never forgot God. You see this in verse 13. This is what he says. Pardon me, my Lord, which I just think is the most awesome thing. Like, God shows up to you and you're like, pardon me, my Lord, God of the universe. Hang on one quick second. We'll get to what you're talking about in a minute, but I've got something else we need to address first, okay? And this is going to be Gideon his entire life, actually. All right. Pardon me, my Lord, Gideon replied, but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are his wonders that our ancestors told about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian. Pardon me, Lord, but look around. You claim you're this God who cares about us, who's powerful. I don't know which piece is missing. All I know is that these Midianites keep trying to take our food. How does that square with the God who brought Israel out of Egypt? It doesn't make sense to me. And this is the trick. This is what we're going to find in this situation, is that trusting in God without an and gets complicated. Because sometimes the external circumstances around us make us want to jump to something else. And yet God continues to stand firm and say, I am all you need. And so generally speaking, when we encounter a God and problem, there's kind of two issues at play. One has to do with what we put in the blank. One has to do with how we view God. And Gideon's going to have to deal with both of these things. And so we're going to jump to verse 14, it's the next verse. And what I want you to see is that God actually doesn't answer Gideon's question at all. He just moves on. The Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? Pardon me, my Lord, Gideon replied. But how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh and I'm the least in my family. Okay, we're not even going to deal with the question of why bad things are happening and God is still God. Forget that for a minute. God's now saying, I'm going to use you to deliver Israel, and Gideon's got another part in me. Because there's one major obstacle here, the first of two, that Gideon has to overcome. And this has to do with his own understanding of himself. See, for Gideon, who never learned simply to put trust in God, he filled in God and, not necessarily with Baal. The blank was himself. God and myself. Pardon me, Lord, I can't do this. And he goes on to give his credentials for why he can't do this, right? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, which was considered one of the weakest of the tribes of Israel, and I'm the least in my family. I am the most nobody of nobodies. You can't out-nobody me. And so you can't come to me and say, mighty warrior, that's not my job. I'm the bottom feeder. I can't do this. I can't save Israel. When we have a misunderstanding of ourselves, God and blank becomes really complicated because it seems like we're not putting trust in ourselves, but this is what's happening. God is offering his goodness, and Gideon assumes he is capable of thwarting it. That's what he really believes. He's such a mess up that God, in his promise for goodness, can be thwarted by Gideon. Completely backwards. Now, if you are an Enneagram student, you know that Enneagram 1s are sometimes called the perfectionists, and they're sometimes plagued with something called the inner critic. This is my wife. I have her permission to share this. She has one of these. And the inner critic is this voice that keeps coming up inside that says, you're not good enough, or what you've done isn't enough. It's not perfect or even acceptable. In fact, it might even possibly be harmful. And that's tricky. Now, the result is ones are really great at perfecting things, right? But there's this drive. Now, I think you don't have to be a one to experience that at least a little bit. I experience it. She lives with it in a different way. But sometimes, when we allow ourselves to go too far down that path, then we get to this position where we assume that our ineptitude is enough to thwart the plans of God. And that's what Gideon is doing. It's the same error, by the way, as someone who has overconfidence, who assumes they can do things without God's help. Either way, it's the assumption that I'm actually capable of thwarting God's plan or doing something without his permission. And when you have a right view of God, when you have not forgotten God, when you actually trust in God, what you remember is that he is powerful, and he is the one who makes things happen. We're blessed to be able to participate in God's story, and that's the cool gift that he gave us. But it's God's story. He's the one going forward and making things happen. And so we find sometimes that by putting ourselves in the God and we don't have sufficient trust in God, that we think we can actually sabotage God's movement, or we think we can do it without him. Our call is to remove ourselves from that position and to elevate God's place in the story. This is what happens in verse 16. The Lord answered, I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive. There's no answer to how. How? No. What matters is that God is at work here, and he's the one who's going to go forward and accomplish this task through Gideon. Gideon has to take himself out of the equation and simply allow him to be used by what God is doing. And that's how he's going to experience the peace of God and the goodness that comes with it. But for Gideon, there's one more hurdle. It isn't just about him. He's really not that sure that he can trust God. We've talked about this even when we were doing the Abraham story, right? In the Old Testament, sometimes they didn't have as complete a view of God as we do today. And so this is even after the Abraham story, but it's been a long time since Gideon's really heard that much about God being active in their lives. Right, this is the whole thing. Their tribe had kind of functionally left God out of the equation, even if they knew who he was cognitively. So now he has to ask himself this question, can this God actually even do what he says? Can this God actually conquer the Midianites? And so he's going to do something bold now in verse 17. Gideon replied, if now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you. And the Lord said, I will wait until you return. Excuse me, God, you've got nothing else to do. Can you hang here real quick while I run over here to test you? Sound good? All right. This guy is bold. I love his boldness. He's just going to throw it out there. And this is because Gideon's on this internal journey. He is trying to figure out who God is and who Gideon is in relation to God. It's a complicated question. It takes a lot of work to figure out. And so now he is so bold that he's confronting the God of the universe and just saying, hold on a tick. Well, this is what happens. Gideon went inside, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah flour he made bread without yeast. Putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot, he brought them out and offered them to him under the oak, offered them to the angel. The angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on this rock, and pour out the broth. Those are the instructions. He's going to follow it, verse 21. And Gideon did so. Then the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread with the tip of the staff that was in his hand. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. And I assure you that this little act of fire coming up from the bread was more than Gideon had ever seen from an altar of Baal. And in that moment, Gideon realizes this God is powerful. This is a God who can make things happen. Yeah, he can probably even take down the Midianites. But what's worse, this is a God whose power is way beyond anything I understand. In fact, I might die. Verse 22. When Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, alas, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. His concern is, I've just experienced the power of God before me. I can't live to tell this tale. It's going to kill me. But God's reply, in verse 23, but the Lord said to him, peace, do not be afraid, you are not going to die. This is the first time we see peace in this passage. Gideon learned that God is not only powerful, God is on his side. God is not only fully capable of destroying the Midianites, God cares about the Israelites. And you realize both those things have to be true. In order to put our trust in God, two things have to be true. One is we have to believe he's powerful enough to take care of anything that happens in this world. That he really is the author of all creation, that it's his story. We have to trust that he is that omnipotent. But we also have to trust that he is good and that he cares for his creation. In fact, a wildly omnipotent God who didn't care for his creation would be even worse, because at any moment we might be snuffed out. But a God who loved us but didn't have very much power, well, that's nice, but now I gotta go find some Baals in my life. But when God is all-powerful and all-loving, well, now we can trust him. And we begin to see that it's in him alone we place our trust. Verse 24. So Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and called it "The Lord is Peace." To this day, it stands in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. The Lord is peace. Jehovah Shalom. God is powerful, and he loves us, so I can find peace. And what's so crazy about this is that the very act of adding an "and" to this process, God "and," is the thing that thwarts our sense of peace. The thing that we're clinging to bring us peace is the very thing that's undermining it, because it prevents us from having a complete, unadulterated trust in God. The Dallas Willard Dictionary kind of talks about peace in this way. It's the deep rest and assurance of good that comes from total abandonment to God. God's good is at work in the world. Circumstances might be difficult for us to understand, but God's goodness is there. He's moving it forward. He is capable, and he is loving. And when we come to that place internally, then that's when we can say, "It is well with my soul," because it hits us at our depth. And anything else that claims to bring peace in this world is but a fabrication, is ineffective as an idol of Baal. It can't accomplish its goal. So when we seek out the Lord who is peace, we do so with total abandon, saying, "God, let there be no ands in my life. May you simply be God, and that's enough for me." Now, if you read the rest of Gideon's story, which we don't have time for this morning, but if you read the rest of Gideon's story, the next thing he's going to feel compelled to do is go and take down the idols of Baal, and he does this. The problem is not everyone else in his village is quite as on board with this situation, right? And so he gets himself in a lot of trouble over this whole thing. Because, and this happens to us too, when we say that in God alone we place our trust, our culture is coming back and saying, "That's fine, but have you also seen this thing on this commercial we just looked at? This is going to bring you some security too. This is going to bring you some peace of mind. For only $5.99, you can have this. And now you don't have to worry anymore. There'll be peace in your life. Promise of stuff, of success, of wealth, of even just distractions. These things are offered to us. And they play on our fears. You don't have to be a particular Enneagram type to experience that, right? I mean, every Enneagram type has a fear. You have the fear of not being good enough or being evil in some way, or the fear of people not loving you enough, or the fear of not achieving enough, or the fear of not finding your own individual identity in the world, the fear of not knowing enough and being helpless when difficulties arise, the fear of not having consistency and support in your life, the fear of missing out, FOMO as we call it, the fear of not being in control of someone else possibly even controlling my life, and the fear of peace simply evaporating before you. There's a whole crash course on Enneagrams. There you go. It's all the deep-seated fears of all nine types. I don't care which you are. We have fears that make peace difficult, and our world is happy to supply answers to address those fears. But the only thing that will ever work is trust in God. John chapter 16. Jesus says this: "I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." This is going to be a Greek word for peace, slightly different than the Hebrew one, so I'm not going to do a perfect word study here, but the idea is basically the same. You experience peace with Jesus, a peace that is all-encompassing. When we put our faith in God and God's story and what he did for us with Jesus, that's everything that matters, and that's completely regardless of what circumstances we find ourselves in. In fact, we're promised, in this world, you will have trouble, and that's not supposed to change the peace. So we had a couple earthquakes recently. I happened to actually be at a camp that some of you know of. It's a camp that our church used to have some connections with. It's called Quaker Meadow. And while I was up there, that's when the earthquakes were striking. And so it happened to be, about 8 o'clock at night or something like that, somewhere in there. And that earthquake shook, and it shook the sanctuary that everyone was in. I wasn't actually in the sanctuary at the time. I was trying to put my daughter down for bed. But everyone who else was in there, they had just been praying and thinking about the camp theme and how God was working in their life. And here's this earthquake, and now they're afraid the structure's going to fall on them. And ironically, because I just think God has a sense of humor, the camp theme that week was unshakable. I can't script this, right? You know, it's... Sometimes I feel like God's sense of irony is overwhelming. We have to be careful as Christians when we theme things, because I think God just kind of laughs at us, although I do sometimes want to just throw on a camp that's like impoverished for the Lord and just see what happens, you know. We cannot depend on the very ground beneath our feet standing firm. That is not promised to us. We can depend on nothing in this world because except that there will be trouble. In this world, you will have trouble. The enemy will be at your door. The ground beneath your feet is quaking. The job prospect isn't going right. The bank statement isn't what I want. My relationship with my family just isn't how I thought it was going to play out. But yet, when these things happen, when these troubles occur, the promise is still trust in God, trust in Jesus. And that's where you're going to experience peace. Because take heart, Jesus has overcome the world. And it takes a certain amount of stepping back and acknowledging that this is all of God's story. And the privilege that we had to play a part in it. The praise band's going to come up. And they're going to work through a song that we actually already did this morning. And it acknowledges in the song that there's a lot going on in this world, a lot that we can't control. But yet, we serve a God who brings peace, a peace that we find when we reinvest our trust that we place in our bank account or our child successes or anything else that has become the idol in our life, when we reinvest that trust back into the God of the universe, when we delete the and respect God only. When we trust in Him fully, in His story that began way before we were born and will continue on way after we die, that's where we find peace. So may we be a people who move that way, who choose every day to say that, God, You are the one that I want to follow. Because as we do that, we will discover that His peace really can completely change our hearts. God, today we know that there's a lot we can't control. There's a lot that we don't understand, but You, Jehovah Shalom, are the God of peace. And so it's to You, God, that we proclaim, we trust You. Everything that's going on in our lives, God, even the things we don't understand, we give to You because it's Your peace that we cling to. In Your name we pray, amen.